Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is, of course, your guide to better cricket. It doesn't matter who you are or where you are, whether you coach it, whether you play it. We're here for the next half an hour or so to help you out. And who are we? Well, my name is David Hinchliffe. I look after things. And then helping me to help you are two very fine cricket coaches. The first is the director of cricket at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garras. How's it going?
All good, thank you very much. It's a very misty day here, but it's dry and it feels as if the cricket season is around the corner. Spring. To me.
Spring is on the way, yeah. Lovely. Secondly, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. Busy today, but all going along nicely and similar to Garras. Yeah, it feels like we're getting close now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. And of course, you've got some high standards to set this week. What with the pre-show name dropping that you managed. So I don't know whether we'll be able to get as many star names in as we did before we started recording. But
Garras will have a good stab at it, though, won't he?
For the rest of the show. Anyway, right. Well, let's see how we can do anyway, and let's frame this around bowling this week, because you know the bowlers always need some attention. We talk about batting a lot, don't we? So let's talk about bowlers and bowlers practice, and specifically what bowlers can do to practice. The default is, of course, that you turn up to nets, you run in for 2.5 hours, and then you have your then you have your 5 minutes at the end when everyone's really exhausted, and you have your little bat at the end when you can cause the least disruption. But of course, if you're looking to improve your bowling, there's more to bowling than waiting in turn for your turn to bowl and then bowling and then waiting in turn again and just keeping going until you're exhausted. So I wanted to go through maybe a few other things that bowlers could do that would mix things up a bit and allow them to develop their game in whatever way they can. So what do you think? What's your favourite things to do training-wise with bowlers other than having nets?
Well, I like to see them doing some technical work off to the side of a net. Say we are running a net and it's their time. They've got 2 hours to practice. It's the only time that they practice in the week. They might get the opportunity to bowl, you know, between 40 and 60 balls in that session. But during the rest of a session, and maybe even before, can they be grooving their action? Can they be working on something specific, using different balls into the side of a net? Using a mirror maybe to shape their action and see how it's looking. Maybe getting somebody to video them from the side if they're bowling just into a target area or something. I think there's loads of things that a bowler can be working on their bowling specifically, which is good around their technique. And then also you could be doing some work around, for example, tactics. And it's something that we're building up as we go into the season now, is having our tactics boards up so people have to set fields. You can be challenging, get two bowlers together and they could go, okay, so what happens if you're bowling at a left-hander and he's on 60 and the game's at this stage of a game, and then they have to move the magnetic counters around to set their field. So when they go out into the middle and they're encountering some of these situations, and instead of standing there a bit clueless, letting the captain do it and then running up and bowling the ball because they're distracted, they can have already planned that out before they go out on a magnetic whiteboard or even on a bit of paper, going proper old school. So those sort of things I think are good. And then you've got the physical stuff, which is, you could be doing loads of work around your legs and your planks and your side planks, and you could be throwing medicine balls around. I mean, it's endless. And for bowlers just to come and bowl at practice, I hope that we're getting to the time where those days are behind us, because there are so many things just to impact upon your bowling that you could be doing in that two-hour session, let alone becoming the best fielder that you can be, let alone hitting some balls so you turn yourself from a number 10 or 11 that can't hold a bat into somebody that can help in a game. So, 2 hours, it's not really long enough when you talk about it like that, is it?
Yeah, stick an extra hour on the end so we can do some more. What about you, Lovers? Do you have any sort of favourite things that you can encourage bowlers to do other than sort of running and bowl and hope to hit the target more times than not?
Yeah, we're kind of at that phase now where we're fairly happy with the technical side of most guys, and not everyone, and obviously it still means everyone's got room for improvement, but most people have made a few changes over the winter and they're starting to establish them. So for some people, there'll be a bit of focus still on affirming what they've tried to change and getting comfortable with that and really ingraining it into how they're going to bowl. We try and make sure there's always some power development in every session, so batters and bowlers, but in this instance, there'll be some heavy ball work and there'll be some med ball work, which is available every session. And for instance, in a senior session, they'll go away and they'll do a little series which lasts about 3 minutes, and they'll try and work through that four times throughout the session. So it might be that they bowl a couple of overs, then they go away and do a little series, bowl a couple of overs, go back and forth four or five times probably in a session, and that's quite a good way to not only to add in the power development, but it also breaks up their bowling and stops them getting into that rhythm where they're just able to flow and flow, which needs to be interrupted, because that's what's going to happen in a match. They're going to bowl an over and they're going to get into rhythm and they're going to have to go and stand somewhere else for six balls. So it's a good way of breaking up that constant bowling rhythm that they develop. From a bowling point of view, what we're trying to do at the moment is just get to grips with exactly what our options are. So this morning, for instance, it would have been going through our basic kind of new ball options of how we're going to bowl for the seamers. So what do we want? We want to have a top of off stump delivery. We want to have, we might want to have a fuller swinging delivery. We might want to have something that's going to be back of a length into the body. Those kind of things, depending on what sort of speed and skill set you've got available. So we're looking at three deliveries with a new ball per bowler, really, is what we're hoping for people to have, and largely one delivery would be 90% of it, but it's just getting to grips with that so people are aware of what they're going to try and do. And then we'll come on to, in the next week or so, our slightly more defensive or our other options that are going to be trying to restrict batsmen when they're trying to attack, and that will then give them a bit of an understanding as to what works for them, and that will spill out into our zonal games, which we've written about before on Pitch Vision, where we try and restrict the direction that batters hit the ball and those kind of things as well, which are all starting to build up in sessions at this time of year. The other thing that I've brought in, which I quite like, and I've done it a little bit in the past, is one new ball. And effectively what we do is we give a bowler a new ball for six balls, and that's it. So they get to take the new ball at a point that they choose throughout the session, and they get six balls with it, and they have to make sure that those six balls are not wasted. And it's just trying to get them in the mentality of, you can't waste a delivery when you've got a new rock in your hand, and you've got to make sure that everyone counts, and sometimes give them a couple of overs throughout a session. But yeah, trying to give them the opportunity with a new ball, but having them know it's limited is a good addition as well. I'm sure you've got a million things you do up there, though, with the bowlers, away from chugging in and bowling, haven't you, David?
Certainly at club level, the challenge is that people are expecting to do a certain thing, and if you offer something else, they might decide that, no, that's no good for me, I just want to come in and bowl, thanks very much. So it is a bit less, you have a bit less influence over, but you have to be a bit more convincing. So yeah, there are times when we do things, and then there are times when I sit back a little bit and don't necessarily let the guys do anything except bowl, because that's what they want to do. So it, especially with the senior players, it is a matter of kind of finding that level and then gradually nudging them towards where you want to go, rather than saying, right lads, today what we're going to do is this, and they'll look at you and say, well, actually I just want to bowl. So there are certainly a lot of things, but I've been, just as you've been saying those things, I've been writing them all down, so I'm definitely going to try and nudge the guys a little bit more towards it. One of the questions I had actually about it, especially regarding technique, is in terms of technical work pre-season running into the season for bowlers, how much of that do you do? Presumably changes is something that you don't want to do a lot of, but it's more sort of reinforcing the good habits, and making sure bad habits don't come in.
Yeah, I think as you get towards the season, I think one of the biggest adaptations is actually running in, isn't it? And having enough distance to run in, and not all indoor halls, because we have to do a lot of work in indoor halls in the Northern Hemisphere. Give us that capacity. So We get out on our hockey pitches as much as possible and give people space. Just put up two sets of stumps and just get them used to running in and hitting their takeoff point and hitting the front foot line in it, however way they want to do that, really. And I think that's really important. One of the worst feelings that I've ever had as a player is standing at the end of my run-up mark, first game of a season in a club match for Ventnor, and just thinking, I've not run in off more than about six paces the whole of the year, and now I'm having to do this. Where the hell am I going to be taken off and landed? And it was horrible, because the last thing I actually was thinking about was where the ball was going to end up and whether it was swinging and what the bloke at the other end's trying to do against me. So it was a horrible feeling, that. And we get them out as much as we can to get used to being able to run in. Equally, in nets, when we're doing one-to-ones, Dan, who does our fast bowlers, works our fast bowlers here, he will have people bowling into the end of a net, so they've got that full length of run-up down the length of the net anyway, even though our run-up is six paces in the bubble. He's actually having them running in off their full mark and bowling from further down the net whenever they're not bowling at a batter, which is, you know, so it just gets them used to that stride pattern. So then when we go outdoors and we start to do that hockey pitch stuff, we can actually put some outcome on the end of it, and their run-up isn't alien to them. So it's a bit of a graduation leading into that, because most of us have got, well, we've obviously in a net, we've got 20 metres, haven't we? Because that's the length of a cricket pitch, you know, give or take 11 centimetres, but and we'll have a bit of a run-up, and most people's run-ups will be less than 30 metres, so you've always got that capacity, really.
Having the hockey pitch around is great, isn't it, for the fast bowlers, for the keepers, I find, as well, letting them actually catch some real balls rather than kind of being stuck in there, and also like a bit of running around, doing a bit of fielding on a pitch that's going to be level. A bit quick and bouncy, but challenging. But it's just it's nice to get out there and use a hockey pitch when you can, because as I call it at school, like being in the blue room, and Sports All Floors Blue at our place, so being in the blue room all winter can be very productive, but also very frustrating at times when you can see that the next progression a player needs is actually probably a bit of space, but. Yeah, getting out on a hockey field every now and then is really useful.
I've done it also on football pitches where I've got the guys to put football boots on and run in and bowl. So they're not doing it in their cricket spikes. And I've had people out in February, so when we haven't been able to get onto the hockey pitches, you know, just going out onto a football pitch or a rugby pitch, you know, a green bit of grass that you don't mind tearing up a little bit. And obviously you're not going to get the outcome off of the surface, so the ball's going to plug in the ground. But actually, as long as you make them aware that we're not looking at outcome, we're just looking to get that feeling, that kinesthetic, which gets them into the crease and what have you. And it's good fun. So for a couple of tours that we've had in December, I've had guys running up and bowling in their football boots, and they've quite enjoyed that experience, because there's a bit of crossover between their two sports, or you know, two things that they enjoy. So there are ways around it, even if you haven't got the fantastic facilities that you know some schools might have. As long as you've got a bit of ground, a pair of football boots, you can give it a go.
What do you reckon to that, David? A bit of February in Scotland outside on the rugby pitch?
Yeah, if it's not frozen.
I've heard that people bowl outside in Scotland as early as September. Sometimes early as August. It happens in August as well.
Time now for the questions section on the show. Very simple format. All we do is we take a couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to the show, or readers to the Pitch Vision website, and we answer those questions. And then we choose the best question of the week, which wins a prize of an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And if you are listening and want to send in your own question, you can do that by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, or get in touch with us via social media, which we'll tell you about towards the end of the show. Couple of short questions this week, but hopefully we can give some good answers. First question is from Soraya, and Soraya says, does staying on your toes help while fielding?
Yeah, it's a good question, that. I suppose the two things that I would say is, at what point would be the first thing, because I don't know about you, but if I was on my toes the whole time I was fielding, I'd probably find that my calf muscle would be a bit tight after a few overs of walking around like a ballerina. But you know, being on the toes is one of those throwaway lines to me. You know, if you're on our toes, then we're going to be able to move quicker. And I think we know that some people are better on the forefoot, and some people are better having their weight slightly further back distributed across your foot plate. But ultimately, you're not going to be on your toes for a whole period of time. Some people don't generate their force into the ground by pushing on their toes. Some people do it slightly differently. So the bottom line is, no, you don't have to be. It's more of a throwaway saying to make sure that people are ready. So the question for me is, are you ready when the ball hits the bat to be able to react in multi-directional fashion to whatever that ball does off of the bat, for you to be able to dive, stop, run, move, and all of that malarkey. So yeah, it's a bit of a throwaway line being on your toes, because A, I haven't seen anybody ever field like a ballerina. I've seen people field in many different ways, but never like that. And it's more of a throwaway line really that coaches have used in the past. But just work out what's best for you, and get somebody to roll you a load of balls. Do you need to walk in a long way? Do you not need to walk in a long way? Do you need to have your legs flexed? Do you not? Just work it out yourself by getting people to throw some balls, and which one you move best from, which ready position you move best from. You get loads of different ones, don't you?
I was at a session on Sunday with some Cricket Scotland Academy boys, and in the fielding section, one of the interesting things that they were talking about was taking a clue from receiving a serve in tennis, in that when they receive a serve in tennis, as the ball is struck, the person receiving the serve is in the air. And then they land, and then as they land, they can quickly move towards the direction of the serve much more quickly than if they'd already done that jump and had their legs flexed. So I've never heard that in a cricketing context before. So do you think that's a useful? It's a useful thing to have a go at, certainly, isn't it? But do you think it's a useful thing a lot of people can get something from?
I think we can learn a lot from tennis in terms of their ready position. Definitely. And most players will be like that. But there have been some players in the past that haven't moved necessarily like that as well, when they're receiving serve in particular. You'll notice that some people will jump up in the air, and when they land, they'll go left foot, right foot, irrespective of which direction the ball's going in. Some people will do the opposite. Some people will land both feet at the same time. So Agassiz would be somebody who would land, because we use this in level 3 actually around ready positions. So Agassiz landed with both feet on the ground at the same time, whereas Roger Federer, obviously they're two fairly fine tennis players, would land with his left foot being the last one that hits the ground. And again, people are very individual, but they were both phenomenal returners of serve. And I believe that Murray is somebody that he jumps up in the air, but one of his feet hits the ground earlier than the other as well. And he would probably be as good a returner of serve as there is on the circuit at the moment. So, yes, there's stuff that we can learn from. Certainly, I'm not a fan of necessarily making sure that we're in that Z position, ready position that I hear being banded around from a fielding point of view, because when I worked with Paul Collingwood, the best catch he ever took to get Matthew Hayden out at Bristol, when he played that square cut off of Harmy, as the ball is on the bat, on a sequencing thing that I've got, he's actually in midair and one of his feet is going to hit the ground before the other, but he's in midair as that ball is hit, rather than being grounded and so-called ready in inverted commas to move.
I think the issue can be that if you want everyone in a Z position or a keeping style position, you're making the assumption that everyone's movement or their speed of movement or the amount they need to move is coming from their leg drive and their leg power, which isn't always the case. Obviously, we know from batting that some people prefer to move using that, and some people prefer to move from a taller position where they can shift their body weight around. So, as we said a lot of the times, it is about finding the right thing for each person, rather than saying this is what you do, this is what works for everyone, which won't be the case. So, if finding what works out for people is the key thing. And in addition to that, finding what works for a person in a specific role that they're playing, because people may find that they like to be positioned in a certain position, a certain way when they're fielding a backward point, yet being at mid-off or being at deep fine leg or being at slip or whatever, obviously going to be slightly different. So learning about yourself and how you like to move in different positions is another thing that's pretty important based on the type of movements you're expected to have in the role you're playing.
And yeah, it boils down back to that point of we saying, well, look, just if experiment with these things, and if you find that they work for you, great. And if they find that they don't work for you, it's not the end of the world. Find what does. And then if you can do that, then it doesn't really matter how you do it, as long as you can do it.
Definitely. And the more you experiment, the more awareness you build about what works for you and what works for you in certain positions. Because you might be standing at slip and feeling that you need to stand slightly differently when you're at point. Well, that would make sense because they're different positions. You're not gonna be in that Paul Collingwood at point position and adopt the same position at short leg, because you make yourself a fairly big target for the bloke that's lining up a sweep shot if you do that. So, you know, we have to adapt constantly, don't we, to where we are on the pitch and to the way that we move. And if we can combine those two as often as possible, that's great. But actually, if I'm standing at short leg, even though I never used to like crouching down when I kept wicket, I never used to like crouching down when I was standing back up, much preferred to be more upright and then move from an upright position. If I did that at short leg, then the bloke that was batting would probably be laughing and lining me up which part of my body he was going to hit. So, you know, we have to be able to adapt to circumstance, but also to ourselves as well and how we like to operate.
Next question is from Bhavan, and Bhavan says, can you give me some tips about the back lift of my bat, please? A bit of a classic one, but of course, you know, it seems to have changed so much in the last few years. It's probably worth going back over sort of the basics of the back lift and how it's the way that it's coached even is changed over the last 10, 15 years.
I watched a thing, the Cricket's Greatest on Dennis Lilly the other day, which is brilliant. And if anybody can get hold of those through watching Sky or through looking on the internet or whatever the case may be, they're so brilliant to track the story of these guys through their career, the ups and downs and everything. It's just a great they're all great examples of how actually it's not a straightforward journey. So that would be the first thing that I would say. The Dennis Lilly one was brilliant because he came back from a stress fracture, bad one, and was the best bowler in the world for a long period of time, which was fantastic. But in it, I noticed that all of the batters had their bat on the ground and tapped their bats as he was running in, and had their bat on the ground on the way to him. Now, if he's bowling at 90 plus, which he probably was for large parts of his career, certainly the first half of his career, he would have been bowling at 90 plus. And obviously, Geoff Thompson was on there as well. He was definitely bowling at 90 plus. You know, to have your bat on the ground is fascinating, isn't it? It's a methodology, if that's the way you play, because we don't see that as much anymore, do we? We saw it more probably with the 1990s, early 2000 group of the Australian batters that were very much coached to have their bat on the ground. But we see people having different starting positions, which are obviously going to have an impact on the type of swing, backswing that they can have and back lift they can have. I prefer backswing to lift, because if we're talking about lifting, we tend to sort of pick it up towards us rather than swing the hands back, and I like to see the hands going back do something when you're lifting that back or swinging that back backwards, so you can get some momentum into the ball. And you see different examples of that. You see people that have very long backswings. So somebody like Darren Sammy, if you can picture Darren Sammy batting, his bat and his hands go a long, long way back. Whereas if you think about somebody like a Brian Lara batting, his hands will go back and then up, or Ricky Ponting, hands didn't go back that far, but they went up and they did something. Because we've got to be able to move that bat through a range of motion, to put some acceleration into it and to give us an opportunity to decelerate the bat if we're looking to defend. So yeah, a Ricky Ponting and a Brian Lara had different back swings, but still had something going on. And, you know, that's my main thing. If I don't see the bat swinging back, then obviously it's going to restrict our options when it comes to defending, attacking, leaving and all of those things. So it's got to do something for me, and that's my biggest thing. And then you've got alignment, really, of where the alignment goes. And I remember back working with Marcus Driscoff. It was struggling against Glenn McGrath, as a lot of people did, because he was bloody good. And Trez was finding that he was pulling his bat slightly behind himself when he was batting, which meant that he had to come around his body a little bit to access the ball. And what that did in turn was expose the outside edge to the ball, which was often nipping about a little bit from Glenn, because he was such a good practitioner of his art. So we just looked to make sure that from if I was throwing at him, then I could see his hands all of the time, and not losing it behind his body, because then that would mean that his bat path was going to be better to the incoming ball. So you got two things for me: what your hands do in terms of swinging it back, and also the alignment that those hands go back to allow that downswing to come straight into the line of the incoming ball.
Lavers, do you make a lot of changes to back swings or back lifts?
It's going to work around similar principles, really. I mean, you might make a change if you've got someone who's not coming down with anywhere near the correct alignment. So if someone's bringing the bat down straight across from third, fourth, slip, gully, etc. And yes, people will often swing back in that direction, but they generally then loop round and come through fairly straight. So if someone's coming down from that direction and effectively cutting across the ball, then maybe there is a room for a little bit of adjustment there. And often it's not necessary to the swing, though. It might be to the position of the upper body, which has got a little bit squared up. And the swing really needs to have a few things to get some power and to prepare yourself. And Gareth's been through them. So a bit of depth is going to help you generate some forward striking momentum down the ground. A bit of height is going to help you get on top of a ball as well. And whether you want to go straight arms to straight arms, which some people do, they don't bend their arms a lot, or you want to go bent arms to straight arms, which would be the slightly more modern way to try and generate even more power. We want to end up with some extension of the arms, so we've got to have somewhere that we're swinging the bat from. And occasionally you'll get guys who are a little bit too wide outside the slip, so you get people who are just hooking it around a little bit behind them. And then whether or not it's a change you make to the hands, to the actual direction you're swinging, or it's an adjustment to the base or the body, you'll find different people working different ways. So as long as you've got that alignment, and as long as you're swinging from somewhere that's going to generate power. And I generally look to have a bit of height in that backswing, because it does help a little bit with getting on top of the ball and preparing for the back foot, which is arguably one of the reasons that someone like a Ponting was so sharp on the short ball for so many years, is that he did have that height in his backswing, and it prepared him and got him in a great position to just get straight on top of it and get his hands there very fast.
Yeah, can I just add on that, if that's all right? Because he explained that to me when he was with us in Somerset, that type of pickup that he had. And effectively, what he would look to do is point the toe of the bat to the sky, because if the bat's weight is over the top of your hands, you're basically unweighting the bat. So all of the weight is carried over the top of your hands. Whereas if that bat, the centre of that bat's weight is behind you, then obviously it feels relatively heavier. So having the bat pointing above his hands lightened the weight of the bat at the top of his backswing, which made it easier to move, which is one of the reasons why he was able to get onto that short ball as well as we saw over the whole of his career. So that's one example of somebody. So if somebody's struggling on the short ball, for me, I'll have a look at what their hands are doing in terms of how far they go back, but also where the centre of the mass of the bat is in relation to their hands, because if they're struggling to get it through quick enough, then there's a good chance that bat is way behind them, and the heavy bit of the bat is way behind them, rather than being directly over the top of their hands.
And we come to the end of another show. It's been a good one. I've enjoyed it very much. But before we go, we just need to do one more thing, and that is decide on the winner of this week's competition, the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two questions on offer were Soraya's question about fielding and staying on your toes, and Bavan's question about the backlift. Which one did you prefer this week, Garris?
Two top questions. I'm going to go with being on your toes, because we hear that probably at most fielding sessions around the world. I would nicely challenge the coaches as to what they mean on that one when it comes back, or if somebody in the field says, come on, you should be on your toes, then what exactly are you asking me to do here? And the bottom line is that they want you to be ready to be able to move in a multi-directional way, and that might not be the ballerina position with those blocks in the end of your shoes.
Yeah, you don't want people to misinterpret that. If you mean it figuratively, you don't want it to be literal. So yeah, you need to be clear on that. Everyone needs to be clear on that. So good point, Gareth. If someone else was listening to the show and they wanted to send their question in and have the chance to win the prize, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's correct. You can also get us through social media in many ways. There is the Pitch Vision pages, of course, which are social media ready. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way through Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. Or Twitter @PitchVisionAcad. You can subscribe to the show if you do that by going to your favourite podcast app, and then you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, click on subscribe, and the rest is done magically for you. If you want to listen to the show in any other way, you can go to the Pitch Vision website and stream it or download the show. You can do that by going to pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys. Bye.